morning. You've tuned in to the International Connection. We are continuing with our radio series on mind control. Today we are listening to part two of a presentation given by Jeanette Westbrook entitled Issues Regarding Prosecuting for Adult Survivors of Ritual Abuse. Jeanette brought legal charges against her father alleging that he had severely abused her as a child and teenager through ritualistic torture and sexual abuse. Her father, a prominent person in society, had the job of overseeing inspections for all nuclear power plants in the U.S. And now, Jeanette Westbrook.
The charges have to be brought in the jurisdiction in which the crimes occurred. So, victim lives in another state, perpetrator lives in another state, but the crimes was committed in Kentucky. You have to file charges in the state of Kentucky. That means the state of Kentucky is going to have to, or the prosecutor is going to have to initiate proceedings to bring that perpetrator back to the state of Kentucky. Complicates cases because a lot of prosecutors don't want to go through that whole procedure of extraditing a criminal back to another state. It really, really complicates it, but it can be done.
What happened with your case?
Yes. Okay. The Attorney General files extradition papers for my perpetrator to be brought from Columbus, Ohio, back to the state of Kentucky, where most of the criminal acts occurred, to stand trial in a criminal court of law. Well, the extradition papers were signed late May. By June the 22nd, the perpetrator was dead. My father had been speaking to the parliament in Hungary. What he was doing over there was, at the time of his death, he was the executive director of the National Board of Boiler and Pressure Vessel Inspectors, which means that he controlled all the inspections for all your nuclear power plants in the United States. And that was one of my most horrible fears, was that I tell all of those messages the perpetrator tells you, if you tell horrible things are going to happen, I'll kill your family, blah, 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 blah. In my mind, one of my biggest fears was, I tell and the perpetrator sabotages a nuclear power plant and millions die. I really felt that. Okay. Perpetrator ends up dead. Well, guess what? Nobody had any intention of telling me that the perpetrator was dead. There was a concerted effort for me not to have that information. I wanted to go to the funeral, but I was threatened. If you come to the funeral, we'll bodily remove you.
Who told you that?
The heir to my perpetrator, which I do not want to say for legal reasons. Okay. It's a little bit unusual. The perpetrator is suddenly dies at home at 3:00 in the morning. No autopsy is done. A private physician comes to his home, signs off the death certificate, and that is the end of that. Very unusual. Somebody who's pending felony charges and is being extradited for those charges. There should have been an autopsy done by a coroner, but there wasn't. And once the body's in the ground, folks, very, very difficult to exhume a body to see if this perpetrator was poisoned, was foul play, was anything out of the ordinary. It's not going to happen after the fact. So, how did I know that the perpetrator was actually dead since I didn't see the body? You know, that was problematic because parts of me didn't want to believe that he was deceased. Well, I was able to get a hold of his last remaining first-degree relative his sister, my aunt, who reveals to me, now that he's dead, she was raped by two of the same family members that had raped me. So, and she assured me that it was his body. I don't know. I may never know, but I'm pretty sure he's a dead man. And what happened to him? Do you think he was murdered before we brought him back to Kentucky to stand trial? I don't know. Who would want him dead? Would cult members want him dead? Do you think the government might want him dead? How would it look? Gee, this person is controlling all these inspections for the nuclear power plants is a sadistic pedophile mentally. Not to mention all the other things that he was into. And when you're looking at the background of your perpetrator, my perpetrator was a Boy Scout leader. My perpetrator was a church deacon. My perpetrator was a Grandmaster Mason. Gee, what's that got to do with it? I don't know. Don't you try to define that. Don't say to the detective, my father was a Boy Scout leader, so therefore this equals that. Let the detective draw their own conclusion to that. You can substantiate your perpetrator has access to a lot of other child victims because he's a Boy Scout leader, because he's a church deacon. After my father's dead, the organization that the perpetrator worked for writes, and Mr. Blank was loved by family, by national board staff, by business associates. He even had a legion of pint-sized admirers, the neighborhood kids. It was common to see a bunch of them gathered in Mr. Blank's yard. He always found time for the children, and he always inquired after their well-being. Such was his concern, and it was genuine. Representing the executive leadership of the National Board, Mr. Blank cast an image of impressive proportion. He met with world leaders. He rubbed an elbow or two with the politically powerful. He occasioned with the captains of industry. Elegantly attired, he slipped neatly into whatever role he was expected to play. Okay. Why pursue? What is the number one attack that the perpetrator uses against the victim? It is silencing the victim. By Judith Lewis Herman in Trauma and Recovery. I think this is a fantastic summary. In order to escape accountability for his crimes, the perpetrator does everything in his power to promote forgetting. Secrecy and silence are the perpetrator's first line of defense. If secrecy fails, the perpetrator attacks the credibility of his victim. If he cannot silence her absolutely, he tries to make sure that no one listens. To this end, he marshals an impressive array of arguments, from the most blatant denial to the most sophisticated and eloquent rationalization. After every atrocity, one can expect to hear the same predictable apologies. It never happened. The victim lies. The victim exaggerates. The victim brought it upon herself. In any case, it's time to forget the past and move on. The more powerful the perpetrator, the greater is his prerogative to name and define reality, and the more completely his arguments will prevail. This is Trauma and Recovery by Judith Lewis Herman. I recommend this book highly. I also recommend, and this is a classic, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape by Susan Brown Miller. It's very important for you to understand the dynamics of rape and how our society looks at rape and abuse. This isn't bad either. Against Therapy. This is sort of like how our psychiatric systems look at abuse. You know, it's that old wandering uterus thing. Judith Lewis Herman, M.D. Well, I think it's kind of interesting. I did bring with me a... And you're, you know, welcome to look at this thing. Oh, I decided that after his death, I heard that the Masonic Brotherhood went up and did some rites at his funeral. Gee, I couldn't go, but they were there. And so I called the Masonic Lodge that he'd been a member of for 40 years because I wanted some documentation for my own self. And sure enough, and I called and told them I was the dutiful daughter. And I'm so sorry. And so I got back the documentation that Mr. Blank of Blank Address was a member of Jefferson Town Lodge number 774 in Blank, Kentucky. Date of birth, blah, 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 blah. He entered his first degree in Masonic Lodge on February 1965, made the second degree in February 66 and made Master Mason in March of 1966 within 1 year. He went all of those degrees. Gee, how is that possible? I don't know. But I got that. Is there a correlation? Well, in this case, for this particular lodge, I believe there is some collaborative evidence there. And that is that there were two other cases that had been prosecuted and convicted, two perpetrators from the same Masonic Lodge to which my perpetrator had been a member of for 30 plus years. Is there a correlation there? Gee, do birds of a feather flock together? Whether it's a Masonic Lodge, whether it's a church, whether it's you name it. I don't know. Are they all this way? I don't know. I'm not going to interpret that for my detective. Let them draw that conclusion. Why is it that all these perpetrators coming out of this certain place, whatever organization it is? Should they look at that? Yeah, I think so, especially since I went out and took pictures of it and it's right above the daycare. Might there be a problem? I don't know. Can I say something about that to police? I certainly can. Gee, did you know that X, Y, and Z case, which was published in the newspaper and convicted, and X, Y, and Z case that was published in the paper and convicted, did you know these two convicted perpetrators belong to this organization? And guess what? My perpetrator belongs to this organization also. Are they going to do something with that in a court of law? Nah. But are they, or is that going to lead your detective to say, yeah, there's something here? Probably. Are they going to talk about that in a public forum? No, they're not. They're going to deal with what is in the statute. That's why every survivor that is able to get through the criminal justice system, you are a star. You are a ray of hope. You are forming a path. You are gathering information and empowerment to give to another survivor because nobody else has given that to you. But you've gathered that information. You'll pass it on. You'll show. People will learn from what you have done. But yes, does it make sense? That just goes to show you. Sex offenders, how many?
4,800.
So there's really almost 5,000 victims.
Just a
maybe two convictions. So what's what's the percentage? Who's good at math? I know you have been programmed for math.
God. It's called, it's stacked against the victim, and the perpetrators pretty much roam free. They do what they want. They rape, they maim, they torture, they kill. And they get away with it. And they get away with it until someone is empowered enough to stop one perpetrator, which means you have stopped or you have prevented potentially 30 victims in the future. That's what you've done when you have the capacity. And no one should ever, in doing this presentation, if you have survivors that aren't able to prosecute for whatever reason, whether it's statute of limitations, whatever, never apply pressure that there's something wrong with that person because they did not pursue a course of legal action. That's just not, it's just not fair, and it's a can be a re-victimization of that victim to say that you're less than because you did not pursue a case. It's just grossly unfair because there's not too many that are able to do it. And as I said in the beginning, one of those reasons is because I don't have children. It would be much, much different if I had children behind me and I in a position of keeping them safe and protected. I never believed that I would be able to protect my own child. I always felt that perpetrators would get access to my children. But I can tell you at this point, there are four siblings. I have two older brothers. There's myself, my sister, who's a year younger than I. None of us have any children. Which, that is statistically very rare for a whole sibling group to have no children. So it has stopped. It has stopped with our generation. It has stopped with yours. It is a horrible price to pay. Oh, I've left something out here that's pretty important. When you move in a criminal case or a civil case, one of the first things you should do is have your attorney freeze his damn assets. Don't give him a chance to hide those assets, because they will. They will make an attempt to do that. And that's one thing a lot of attorneys don't even know. Immediately, file, freeze those assets. So you have something to get access to, because, hey, you want to... $500,000 suit against your perpetrator, say it's a civil suit, and he's hidden all the assets and he's filed bankruptcy. There goes your dream of having your therapy paid for. Was I cut out? Yeah, there was an attempt to cut out, and I pursued myself without an attorney. My access to my measly $12,000 inheritance. $12,000 is a lot to me, though. I paid off some medical bills, and there were some medical bills. And gee, you know, he could have gotten out of this early on, because when I filed the warrant and got him into district court, guess what the perpetrator tried to do? There's another thing, folks, you got to learn, is that there's this thing called the judge's chambers. It's sort of back here somewhere. Somewhere back there. And in the judge's chambers, there are things that happen there, and it's called a done deal. There are deals that go down back there that you don't have access to. And that's one important reason why I had my own attorney, because I want her back there finding out what the done deal is. So when the perpetrator comes in the district court after I filed the first degree rape charges, There's the old plea bargain, okay? The deal, they want to make a deal. Well, the deal was, his attorney says, well, gee, he's willing to plead guilty to a misdemeanor of facilitating child sexual abuse, which is a misdemeanor. Well, believe it or not, that just gave a lot more oomph to my police detective, because it verified everything that I've been talking about, multiple perpetrators. If you're facilitating child sexual abuse, guess what? There's more than two people involved. The victim, the perpetrator, and the one facilitating. So he's willing to plead guilty that he's facilitating the abuse. So, hey, I didn't do it, but you know, I sort of facilitated it. And in lieu of pursuing the further criminal action against him. Well, and my attorney kind of marches in. She's back there, too. Well, we won't pursue it if you'll give her $50,000. Or his attorney throws out $50,000. They come back to me. Will you be willing to accept a plea bargain, a misdemeanor plea bargain, of facilitating child sexual abuse, and $50,000? Nah, I wasn't willing to do it. That wasn't going to buy me. But there, and you know, God forbid for me to be the judge of that. If it was easier on you, you could get $50,000, and this was enough for you, take it and go. If you can actually get access to that $50,000, and that's questionable. They may say that as a done deal, and then after the fact, well, gee, I'm bankrupt. So you got to be careful about accepting plea bargains and money. You want to see the dollar on the table ahead of time. I was not willing to accept that plea bargain, that misdemeanor plea bargain, because I knew that Kentucky had passed the sex offender registry. Well, now everybody's got the sex offender registry, thanks to Megan's Law. Okay, at the time, this is in 1992, I wanted to make sure that he went on, I wanted a felony conviction, because only felony convictions go on the perpetrator list, the convicted perpetrators. So in order to stop my perpetrator, I knew I had to have that felony conviction. That way, it would go out to all of these jurisdictions and warn everyone that he's a sex offender, and it would further open the door for his other victims to file criminal charges. You know, that's still kind of up in the air. They're not sure how they want to do that. From what I understand at this point, police jurisdictions are going to have access to the information, but that's sort of being challenged, I think, by the American Civil Liberties Union. Does anybody know any more information concerning that? As far as I know, it's still up in the air.
Was your mother alive during all this? And how does she...
She's a co-offender. My mother, concerning my mother, and I always leave this out because I just don't want to talk about it too much. No, don't, please don't. It's my own stuff there. That my mother was 16 years old when she had her first child. My mother had four children right in a row. My mother was an only child. As I found out much later, and this is doing your homework, the person I was told was my mother's mother, in fact, is not my mother's mother. From what I've been able to find out, my mother's father was a doctor, and supposedly my mother was the child of some woman that he had an affair with. I don't know who my mother's mother is. I've never met any of her relatives. I don't know anything about her family. The person I was told was my grandmother. She's still alive. She's 96 years old. I asked her about my mother's heritage and about that, and she just gave me the answer, let that rest, let's not talk about it. So it was a clear message to me, I'm not going to say, she's not going to reveal, and I will probably never get that information unfortunately, I do a lot of minimization concerning my mother's abuse. She's clearly a co-offender, and what I mean by that is that she knowingly participated in that. She actually used her medications on me for my venereal infections. So she knew about that, but tell you the truth, 35 years ago, if she'd gone to say, oh, my husband is raping my daughter, you think anybody would have done anything about it? No. Nobody would have done anything. It just wasn't done then. They would have most likely, well, sent her over to the mental hospital, shocked the shit out of her. That would take care of that, give her some drugs, and blame it on a wandering uterus. I'm not exaggerating one bit there. That actually is what happened a lot of times. So.
What level are your slogans on as far as their own denial or their own reality of what happened?
My sister's totally supportive. She gave a deposition to the police concerning her own victimization and her witnessing of what she knew about my victimization. My sister was not ritually abused. My sister is not a multiple, but she has typical amnesia and dissociative symptoms, as many trauma survivors have. My oldest brother pretty much took over my... I want to refrain from answering that. My two older brothers are not supportive. They're in denial, although my oldest brother admitted to me that my father took a 2x4 and beat him up with it in the basement for getting a bad grade on his report card. Now, I could have told anybody. I was not there, and I did not see that. We're talking about traumatic forgetting, what Dr. Whitfield was talking about this morning. My sister says, oh, yes, you were. You were standing right beside me. Perpetrator had called all of us to the basement. My mother, my sister, my two brothers, of course, our oldest brother getting the punishment. We were all there to witness this incident. My oldest brother admits that to me on the telephone. I tell him, and he admits that that took place. But like a lot of victims, he minimized that. He sided with the perpetrator. Is it like, I don't know. I don't know what it holds for them.